You know, really, Chris Baggett, who was coming out of R.R. Donnelly and wanted to do something completely different and thought, why not buy a chain of dry cleaners? You know, this is late 90s. In fact, when Chris Baggett calls me now, it will still say Sanders Cleaners, which is funny. I never updated it to Exact Target.
Early to bed, early to rise, eat right and advertise. Early to bed, early to rise. And one more thing, get your name out there.
Hello, and welcome to Paleo Ad Tech. I'm Marty Kine.
And I'm Jill Royce. And we are the hosts of this podcast that looks at the first two decades of advertising and marketing technology.
From double click to double verify and everything in between.
Get your name out there.
We are delighted this week to welcome Scott McCorkle to the program. Scott is currently CEO and co-founder of MetaCX, an outcome-based collaboration tool for software buyers and suppliers. But to get there, he started by studying computer science in college and then got his MBA at Indiana University. Scott worked at Eli Lilly and IBM, among others. And then he joined ExactTarget in 2005 as the president of technology and strategy. He was part of the team that brought ExactTarget public in 2012 and sold ExactTarget to Salesforce in 2013. And he was CEO of the Salesforce Marketing Cloud until 2016. So what we like to do to kind of warm up here is start with a random personal question. So if you are ready, why don't you tell us what your childhood dream career was, if you had one?
There was this short period of time where it was to play Major League Baseball. I was not great at baseball, then had like some year or two out of nowhere. I'm not sure what happened, but then I quickly went to not being good again. So that was short-lived. But I'll say I came from a very rural agrarian upbringing. I did not grow up on a farm, but I grew up working on farms. And I've always wanted, even when I was a kid, you know, maybe more high school age, but to have a fish farm. I'm fascinated about fish and the economics of growing fish in three-dimensional columns of water. You cannot stack cows on top of each other, but you can stack fish on top of each other.
So you decided to pursue an MBA after college. What was the plan there?
You know, I had this technical degree and was a technologist and enjoyed programming and, you know, this is a childhood thing too. I had a very modest upbringing, but somehow my parents were able to snag an Apple IIe in 1983. And I kind of loved programming that thing. And I just felt comfortable in business settings, maybe is the way to say it. I enjoyed more than just the technology. I liked working with customers. I liked the idea of things outside just the core technology, maybe like pricing, marketing, some of those topics. And it just felt like getting some formal instruction would be helpful. You know, I'm not a good reader on my own, but when I have discipline applied for me, I do like, you know, to lean into things and learn. And sometimes that structure is helpful. And I thought it'd be helpful for just learning more about the business way of the world.
What was your first exposure to actual marketing technology?
You know, the whole notion that you could have software and enterprise grade products actually using things like email to engage with customers. I mean, that is so obvious to us now. Like, to go back in time where that might have been a novel idea, it's really crazy, isn't it? But you go back to, you know, 98, 99, 2000, and clearly a first crop of companies that had already appeared. And of course, websites, you know, probably leading the way. But the idea of this like direct engagement and doing that in a business setting, you know, really it was meeting the ExactTarget founders in, you know, the end of 99. I had just started a company and they were at early stages of their ideation and trading notes on potential investors. And I just really felt attracted to that idea then from the ExactTarget founders, and just the fact that we could be approaching interactions with customers at scale, deciding what and how to say something just was very fascinating. So It was 5 years before I joined ExactTarget in an operational role, but I feel like I was kind of there at the beginning with those early ideas from Chris Baggett and Scott Dorsey.
What was the company that you started, Scott?
It was called Mezzia, M-E-Z-Z-I-A, and this was the early days of B2B e-commerce. So if you go to the Ariba, Commerce One, Free Markets, Vertical Net, remember all those companies way back then? And you know, the idea that we could be removing friction in business transactions, just like then Amazon and others were doing on the B2C side. So we launched into that. I just came out of IBM. So I was acquired into IBM, a company called Software Artistry, where I ran engineering, and you know, just couldn't wait to try to create something from scratch. And that was the first time. And that was the first dot-com bubble, for those of us that remember that. You know, the NASDAQ was, you know, 5,000 back in, you know, that time period. And so yeah, we were raising money into the dot-com bubble burst. And you know, it wasn't the best of outcomes for that product. And we ended up, Marty, pivoting to really manage the capital spend. So we got less the sort of supply transactional and more into how organizations think about capital spending. But the, you know, I take great pride in this. The software is still kicking. So here we are two decades later. We were acquired by a facilities management company in Boston that uses this as a spend management platform for large capital projects. So, you know, there's no real great, you know, PR or financial success out of that thing, but that great experience. And then
Mezzia still lives.
Oh, it's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive.
So you mentioned brainstorming, chatting with the founders of ExactTarget, including Scott Dorsey. How did you actually meet them? Was it a mutual introduction?
It was. It was an investor group formed in Indianapolis out of the then Software Artistry, which Software Artistry was the first publicly traded software company in Indiana back in, that was 94. And then that founding team created an advisory group called Volatus. Just a lot of us folks that were starting companies in the indie ecosystem then would pass through them, and they introduced us.
So there's an Indiana theme to your career. Did you ever feel tempted to go somewhere else?
I did. You know, but then it just, there was never time, I guess, which sounds kind of odd, doesn't it? But, you know, travel everywhere. And I come from the product side, decidedly, you know, even the MBA and all that. You know, I've been product focused for a whole lot of my career. And I think if that product focusedness had me sort of stationary, as a lot of product people are, maybe I would have felt the need to have moved. But I always have spent so much time in the field, probably 80%. Given that I'm traveling everywhere anyway, it struck me that I could really live wherever I wanted. So in a way, I feel perhaps a bit ahead of my time in the way we're viewing work from anywhere now. But I, you know, I like where I live. My family's here. You know, you spend a lot of times in innovation centers all around the world. But it's you know, I think now I'm pretty rooted.
The ExactTarget, so in its initial sort of vision and stage, what was the vision and the opportunity that the founders had identified?
You know, really, Chris Baggett, who was coming out of R.R. Donnelley and wanted to do something completely different and thought, why not buy a chain of dry cleaners? You know, this is late 90s.
Why not?
This is new. This is new story. Yeah. In fact, when Chris Baggett calls me, now it will still say Sanders Cleaners, which is funny. I never updated it to ExactTarget. Yet Chris wanted to connect to his customers. I mean, he had this marketing, database marketing background. He saw email as a way to interact at scale, put out the, you know, collection box and, you know, put your email address here. And the ExactTarget was born. So that notion of direct digital communication and interaction with your customer at scale is something that Chris saw. Scott Dorsey, his brother-in-law, coming out of Kellogg with his MBA, connected to the idea in a very profound way. They were very, very, very effective co-founders together with a passion and a conviction that was intoxicating, that there's a world coming here that we all see now ahead of us, you know, right in front of us with all of our digital marketing tech and ad tech products and platforms. They saw all that very early.
So how did you, what was that phone call? How did you end up actually joining ExactTarget?
You know, those early meetings where we're trading notes and each trying to get our companies funded and talking about all our ideas, we would meet at this breakfast place every Thursday morning at 7 a.m., which we each reflect on that now, not being morning people. We can't believe that we were having 7 a.m. morning meetings. But it just really created a friendship and a connection. And when the time came for the company I had started to have a place to go, it was clear it just needed to be part of something else. So, you know, called Scott and Chris and joined then in 2005.
Can you talk a little bit about sort of early product strategy and how it sort of evolved over the years?
I think a lot of folks still on the outside of digital marketing platforms maybe don't fully appreciate the transactional intensity with those systems, you know, and just this massive transactional volume. And so go back to then, you know, 2005 when ExactTarget, you know, it was really taking off and growing very quickly. You know, just to keep the lights on and keep the platform scaling took a tremendous amount of effort. And you know, we were our own data centers back then. So there was a lot of shoring up and getting the platform to where it could scale. And then this data element, just like building a model for customers to really bring in whatever data source they wanted. And because kind of two funny stories with that, you know, one, just to not create friction and make that be free, you know, there was like, we didn't charge for data then at any level. It was all CPM based on sending volumes. And then, you know, you worry a lot about data, you know, oh my gosh, we got all this data and we had data policies with our customers and we would delete data after a certain amount of time. And we would, of course, always delete data at whatever customers request. But deleting data against super transactionally intensive databases can wreak havoc, especially the SQL database architectures. We could talk different data architectures now. So we decided to stop deleting data. So because it was just creating too much havoc and we were growing so fast, we could never delete enough data on the back end to really matter on the front end, you know, because there's just so much more coming in from new customers. There was this vision of marketing automation that we now all see that would manifest in products like Journey Builder that we all know. Those ideas were alive, you know, back in 2004, 2005. There was an early effort we called AIM, Automated Interaction Management, which never left the design phase because some other priorities just kind of took hold. But we would all look at it now and see it as an early Journey Builder.
But you basically automated something that a lot of people just did manually.
And, you know, really, I think we have to give credit a little bit here to the B2B folks. So if you look at like Eloqua, Marketo, those platforms, you know, really from the beginning thought in terms of those, you know, kind of journeys, if you will, you know, it's just not just because the volume was lower than the B2C platforms, but, you know, I think there's just a mindset of advancing a prospect through some life cycle. So you know, I can say we were influenced by those platforms as well. You know, I've gotten to know Mark Organ, the founder of Eloqua, here over the last year or so, you know, much better than I would have known him back in the day. And so it's kind of fun to trade notes. But I think you got to give a lot of category creation credit to those B2B platforms.
Get your name out there.
So to that point, how did you guys think about and what was the inspiration for Journey Builder?
There's a fun story here. And, you know, I'm trying to like just quickly run through my brain here. Like is there a statute of limitations of NDAs? I don't think so. It's less that.
Yeah, I don't think they last forever. Don't worry.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I say that in a joking way, but you know, you just like tell some of these stories. So Journey Builder, some of these initial seeds that went back, you know, 2004, 2005, of what we were calling AIM, and then a lot of foundational work just on the platform. And then let's come around to 2011. We were working very closely with Microsoft and the Office 365 team. Matt Fleckenstein was Vice President of Relationship Marketing for Microsoft. And he really was a terrific catalyst to point out the gaps that existed sort of from the pure play enterprise, I'll say ESPs. So you like the Cheetah Epsilon, all those folks. Here's the ExactTarget crew coming up, you know, increasingly on the enterprise. And then there were the B2B folks like a Marketo and Eloqua, those companies. And, you know, Matt was really influential pointing out to me and others within Exact Target, we're already working with Microsoft, about how a platform could, at massive scale, think about individual consumers on a journey. Matt's vision for how you wanted to launch and manage the Office 365 was a huge catalyst to that. So I think that the connections, which would have been in October timeframe or September timeframe of 2010, Matt, Scott Dorsey and I having breakfast, kind of the last day of connection, he's sharing a lot of this vision and it just hit right place at right time. And it's like, let's go co-create. Microsoft was all in and we were all in, and we invested kind of incremental millions of dollars on top our current roadmap to advance this concept of Journey Builder. And then it unveiled Connections 2011.
So one thing, Scott, that Exact Target was known for was, you know, the orange color scheme and content marketing, but also the big events and the rabid community of fans. And it had a kind of a whole aura around it, which you felt it. You mentioned Connections at every year. How did that happen? Was that a conscious decision or did it happen organically?
I personally believe Scott Dorsey is an enlightened level 5 leader. And you know that is going to have an impact on how people feel about their roles and the care they take with themselves and others. And I think marketers are a lot of fun. I mean, there are less fun groups to hang around than marketers. So you kind of get them all. So, you know, I talked to folks about, you know, what responses conferences were like, or, you know, some, and it feels like, you know, they did a pretty good job too. So I think it's just a fun community that loves to innovate together. But I think Exact Target really made culture a priority and recognized that you can't will culture to exist. You have to have the right conditions for culture to evolve. You know, in some ways, culture is the exhaust of how companies make decisions and treat people. Settles in after you get through the big release, after you get through some crisis, after you have something anticipated happen. How do you treat those? How do you treat your team?
Who came up with the orange?
That was a combo, and I'll reference a recent Forbes article just last week. Forbes interviewed Scott Dorsey about what we call the Friday Note, a weekly update to the team. Then orange was brought up as part of that article. You know, the company getting big, and you know, Scott referred to the IPO quiet period that we were in and feeling we couldn't talk to the team in ways that we had before, and then out of the quiet period. And let's just give it a name. You know, something that has a name can be managed and manipulated and identified. You know, it's the way the human brain works, right? Like language, we put meaning to things with names. So Scott and Tim Kopp, our CMO, came up with like orange as one of our brand colors, just to represent culture, and in a way to be mindful of what our intent was with culture by giving it a name and establishing our expectations.
So you went public in 2012, I think, and then Salesforce came along in 2013. Can you just kind of briefly tell us, you know, what led Salesforce to you guys and what was the thinking there and what was Exact Target's response?
I recall we had 7 quarters as a publicly traded company. This is interesting. I mean, it's just the market had started to consolidate. So all those B2B folks first. And if you look at what the large enterprise software companies like a Salesforce, their direction, you know, would it benefit from the kind of capabilities that an Exact Target had? Yes. Would Exact Target benefit from being part of a company like that? You know, it's really a calculus of what's best for these ideas, what adds the most value to the marketplace, what will be best for the employees. You know, I think just coming out of Dreamforce and what I read some reports from Salesforce Analyst Day, talking to the financial analysts, the track record of successful acquisitions was really held up as a part of Salesforce's growth. And of course, there have been some very notable acquisitions here the past couple of years. But to look at a company like Exact Target, you know, a 300 million-ish run rate at time of acquisition, now significantly north of a billion, And then you look at team members, you know, now still part of the company in very successful roles. You sort of look at that, and it working backwards makes it feel like, you know, that was a good decision. What would happen otherwise? Don't know. We don't get to A/B test companies. But I think it's just, there's a feeling of timing. And then if you think the market's going to consolidate, which we did, and I think that's proven to be true, you want to be on the front end of that, not the back end. So I think it just all came together, that you know, a close relationship with Salesforce, longtime partners, you know, it's fun to see it having worked.
And coming in, you know, I did spend about 6 months at ExactTarget prior to the acquisition. So I have a funny little place in this conversation, which is I got a little bit of the ExactTarget culture and then quite a bit of the Salesforce culture. The cultural fit actually was pretty dead on there, because there was something really special at ExactTarget and, you know, equally on the other side.
Yeah, I think cultures blend and things merge and there's an adaptability, things change, you know, it has to be pliable. And I think, you know, there's never been a company grow like Salesforce has grown. And, you know, for you just look at the opportunity to have that team part of that success story, I think is terrific.
Yeah. And I mean, if you had gotten with all the other kind of market dynamics correct, if the cultural fit had been wrong, I wonder how that would have actually played out.
There are, you know, other companies in that space that have likewise made lots of acquisitions, and you see some of them working, some of them not working. You know, I think one dimension to that is market leadership or not market leadership. At that time of acquisition, ExactTarget was growing faster than any of our competitors by a meaningful margin. And, you know, from a market cap perspective, most of us were publicly traded then. You had the highest market cap. So if I could be so bold as to say those are characteristics of market leader, then I think acquiring a market leader is different than acquiring not a market leader. And if you need that alignment to happen and you acquire not the market leader, then it's even more of a challenge to make it all work. Not that it won't work or can't work, but it's harder. You know, Salesforce went right at the market leader and said, we're going to get this done. And there we are.
So what inspired MetaCX? What does it do? What does it sell for?
If we go back to 98, 99, 2000, you know, and I was, you know, enterprise software in the mid 90s, shipping plenty of product on 5 1/4 floppies or even CDs. And then here we now, of course, deliver software as an enterprise or as an internet service, clearly, you know, changed the world and highly effective. And we multi-tenant architecture is the efficiency from all that. But, you know, the mindset, I'm not so sure it changed that much from instead of shipping on physical media, we'll have it software delivered as an internet service to an enterprise. Well, we know enterprise and companies exist in ecosystems and value chains. What is demand fulfillment for one company is strategic sourcing for that company's customer. And then that is feeding into yet more of a value chain. You know, we could all put our MBA hat on back to that. And Michael Porter, 1985, Competitive Advantage, talking value chains. It just feels like we haven't written software to really support that. So with MetaCX, we look at what companies establish when they enter into a relationship as an expectation of value exchange. And if we can manage that at ecosystem levels, then we can really offer a higher level of enterprise software-ness, where we actually have companies that are together in value creation, not separately managing, you know, very important transactional systems. You know, businesses would stop in the tracks without it. But we think of MetaCX and even the name Meta, we think of sitting on top of the existing information architecture that any company would have for the purpose of connecting companies for value delivery. And that sounds abstract, and it is. And, you know, part of our challenge as early companies to make that more approachable and adoptable. But we think that there's a vision there that's interesting.
Solving problems we've been trying to solve as long as we've been trying to solve marketing problems. So I'm going to ask one more question. Looking back, when you think about kind of people and vendors, which would you kind of call out as having the biggest impact on MarTech over the last 2 decades?
You know, I think everyone thinks of their coming of age, let's say, with respect to product offering company as the golden era, maybe. But you know, I think there's something to that period of time where you're coming out of that first generation of platforms to the ExactTarget, Silverpop, Responsys. I mean, there was a collection of innovation, you know, around then that feels kind of inflection-y. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I just think like what, so, you know, that, you know, from 2005 to 2012-ish period, I think that was a big moment of innovation that happened with this coming of age of digital interaction. And along that, you know, a lot of best practices, you know, from canned spam to some of the SMS regulations and just like a settling how this should all work. And there's kind of a whole bunch of companies, like I mentioned, that I put in that category that are fun to think back on.
Like inflection-y.
It was a big time in ad tech as well. We had 2007 was sort of the beginning of real-time bidding, and it was a big year for DoubleClick was acquired. Google sort of started up their non-search part of their business. So it was right around 2007, 2008. Feels like a big moment.
It really does, doesn't it? Thank you.
And we would like to thank Julia Douglas for letting us use her music, Julia Douglas with two S's.com.